Good evening, everyone. Good evening. You've tuned into Paradigm Shifters, and this paradigm shifter that we've got today in this wonderful show is going to really get you waking up to what we all know, which is that we can create our reality, but it takes a little work. So welcome to the show, Terry McBride.
Thank you, Veronica. It's a delight to be with you.
Yes, and you've been through, it is for me as well, Terry, but you have been through, at 24 years old, you were given such a health sentence, it's just enough to make your hair curl. But now you're a little older than that, and you moved your way through it using, what, your heart, your mind, your inspiration. So let's talk about
mostly my mind. You know, when I started, you know, I was in my early 20s when I had a spinal fusion. The spine got, during surgery, the spine got infected with E. coli bacteria.
And I had never heard of that before. That's terrific. That's awful, isn't it?
Yeah. E. coli is a bad bug. Mm-hmm. There just isn't a lot of antibiotics for it. And over the next 11 years, I had like 27 major surgeries. Because with E. coli, they essentially have to go cut it out. And with the infection in my spine, I always had to have what they call a draining sinus, you know, a hole from my abdomen going all the way down to my spine where the fluid could come out from the infection. And
was that pain? Was that really painful?
Oh, at times, I mean, it was, yes.
Okay.
In fact, I was thinking last night after, you know, I did the workshop at the Unity Church here in Bellingham, and when I came back last night, I was sitting thinking, and I thought, when did you really decide to be a teacher? And what came to me was one night when I was screaming into my pillow in the hospital, nobody deserves to hurt this much. And that was sort of the, you know, I didn't know it at that time, but that was sort of the declaration of, you know, this has got to stop. This pain and suffering and believing, you know, in pain and suffering has got to stop. I mean, I didn't know that's what was going on at the time, but
mm-hmm. Well, tell me this. So you took an interesting route. Were you already a metaphysician? Were you already on the spiritual path?
No, I was not. I mean, my mom was real positive and real upbeat about believing in your dreams, but, you know, people talk about all things are possible if you believe they are, you know, stay focused on your dream. But the people I knew, you know, they didn't all have the life they always loved. They weren't consistently applying choice in their life. So these metaphysical principles are talked about. You know, I mean, I see people all the time. They have a sticker on the refrigerator that says, "The universe awaits my intention." Mm-hmm. But are they really, you know, my question when I speak is, are you really using these principles to believe? To really believe that your intention, you know, sets the universe in motion, that kind of thing.
Well, and tell me this, so if you're 24 years old or whatever, and you're screaming into your pillow because you're in excruciating pain, and they're carving up your body with the prognosis not being very vigorous, it's pretty interesting that you would come up with that. Like, that's the challenge we all need to... Not that we all need to be in excruciating pain, but we need, when we're in challenges, to really get with the belief structure and the creating, don't we? I mean, that was pretty brave of you to do that.
Well, when early on, when once they said, oh boy, this infection, I mean, at first I had the infection, they said, oh, we'll fix this. But then after about a year and, you know, and six surgeries into it, that's when I was at the University of Washington Medical Center, and they came in and they said, look, this infection has spread. It's in your abdomen. It's throughout your pelvic area. It's eaten holes in your colon. It's followed both your sciatic nerves and your thighs. And we have to go in and clean all that out, and you're not going to come out of this hole. And that's why, you know, the name of my book is The Hell I Can't.
But it took you a few years to get that feisty about it, didn't it?
Well, I had given my trust. I had given my, you know, the reality of my life over to allopathic medicine. Mm-hmm. I mean, whenever I got sick before, I went in the doctor, they do this to this, and they fixed me. Mm-hmm. And so I was just assuming they were going to fix me. And then when all of a sudden allopathic medicine came in and said, oops, we've reached the limits of our science. You cannot expect to come out of this hole. It was like, well, now what do I do? Mm-hmm. Now what do I do? But in that time, somebody gave me a book by a fellow named Maxwell Maltz. He was a famous plastic surgeon. It's called Psycho-Cybernetics. And on page two of that, he says that we have this thing called a self-image. It's our beliefs, our attitudes, our opinions, our emotions, and he sort of grouped all that into our self-image. And on page two, he says, all of our, you know, attitudes, opinions, beliefs, even our abilities are always consistent with our self-image. And then the next line, he says, and we can change our self-image. So I took that to mean that I can, if I can change my self-image and my abilities are always consistent with my self-image, that means I can change my abilities. And so that's when I started studying what you and I call metaphysics.
And were you in the throes of your illness at that time? Your illness.
Yeah, I was right in the middle of it, right in the middle of it. You know, and I had played with the power of the mind. I went to Everett Community College. It was Everett Junior College back then. And my psychology professor was only a couple years older than I was, and he did his master's thesis on hypnosis. And so he and I used to sit around and talk about the power of the mind, and under hypnosis, you know, when a person gets into a state, you can go in and reprogram the unconscious mind, if you will. And then when you reprogram the unconscious mind, then the person acts like that. And so I was interested in the power of the mind, the ability of consciousness, if you will. But it was when I got sick that I decided, you know, I better study this stuff. And then I brought in the spiritual aspect, because around the sixth surgery, they said, look, the chances of you getting well are 1,000,000 to 1. You would need a miracle. Now, for me, this young guy, where I came from, miracles involved God. And so I began to take a different look at some of the scripture references. You know, all things are possible if you believe they are. Whatever you ask for in prayer, believing you shall have it, you shall have it. The faith of a mustard seed will move a mountain. Well, how do I develop the faith of a mustard seed? How do I develop belief? So that's when I began to really study this idea of how do I take charge of what's going on in my mind? And as I mentioned Sunday at the Unity service, one of the greatest things about my healing, because now I'm 68 and perfectly healthy. I mean,
yeah, you look pretty feisty and you look pretty fit, I thought.
I'm real thrilled with who I am. And I remember, I mean, I had a colostomy where I went to the bathroom in a plastic bag, and they said the lower end of my colon would never heal. I would probably have that colostomy forever. I'd probably lose the use of my legs. I mean, so what I said on Sunday was the greatest thing about my healing is really not that I got well. For me, that's the greatest thing. But for the people that I work with and coach and who come to my workshops, the greatest thing about my healing is when I started studying this stuff, I didn't believe I could ever be really healthy. I thought I could make a difference in my mind. Maybe I wouldn't suffer so much. Maybe I wouldn't be in depression so much. I think I mentioned Sunday I started using these principles so I wouldn't cry myself to sleep every night.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it?
And so I knew I could take charge of things like that. I could think, you know, when I go to bed, instead of thinking about poor me, ain't it awful, aren't I in pain, I could go to bed and think about how healthy my children were, you know, how blessed I was to have a wife that was supporting me, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I could change what I thought about and thereby not cry myself to sleep, if you will. But as I began to study more and more, what I began to, you know, there were great teachers that said, no, if a person changes their mind, they can actually change the results they can produce. They can take charge, you know, if you will. You can take charge of your creative mind, and in doing that, you can begin to understand how powerful one's consciousness, one's belief
And you had a wife and kids at that time, did you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had one when I started the surgeries. I had one daughter, and then about a third of the way through, then I had another daughter.
Mm. And it must have been a challenge for your wife. Did she go into these programs with you?
She supported me. She didn't study as much as I did, but she was a rock. Mm. I mean, I think she visited me. I mean, I was sick for 11 years. I was 27 surgeries. I think every night she was there. Every night.
Wow, good
she
for her.
She came to the hospital when I was in the hospital. Yeah, she's just an incredible woman. We're not married anymore, but mm-hmm. I have a great deal of respect for her.
Wow.
I don't think I... In fact, I wouldn't have made it if it wouldn't have been for my wife and daughters.
Hmm. And your daughters came to the hospital, too?
I'd have given up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd have quit, but...
Because I was thinking that you really do need some cheerleading to... when you're dealing with pain and personal fragility, people do need cheerleading, don't they?
Well, I think they need support more than, I would call it support more than cheerleading. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody who's just there. Because in the beginning, everybody was a cheerleader. Oh, you can do it. Don't buy into this. But after the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th surgeries.
Ooh, yeah.
All of a sudden, some of the people who in the beginning were saying, you can do it, they changed their mind.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about that in my book. I call it the perhaps models.
Mm.
That when somebody fails enough times at a dream, you know, initially when somebody says, this is my dream, people tend to support them.
Mm-hmm.
But when you try and fail and try and fail, when the failures add up to some magical number, they will subtly, many people will subtly encourage us to face reality.
Right.
They don't say face reality. They say perhaps the healing you're looking for may not include the healing of your body.
Well, and you did go to the psychiatrist at some point over that, didn't you?
Well, I didn't go. They sent me to one. I was in the hospital, and they'd get patients to go work with other patients. And one morning, this woman walked in and with her hospital pajamas and hospital robe and introduced herself and said, I've had a colostomy for 17 years, and mine doesn't bother me a bit. I hated my colostomy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the doctors had sent her in to talk to me. And so I said, look, I don't want to talk with you. She said, I know you don't, but you need to hear this. Once I accepted my human limitations, I learned that I could live with my colostomy. And I said, I don't want to talk with you because I'm not going to live with a colostomy. And I said, I'm reading these books. And she said, I'll bet we've read some of the same books. And it was like, oh. And so finally I just kicked her out of my hospital room. She told the doctor who sent her. He made some calls, and then they sent me to see a psychiatrist.
Aha. And what did the psychiatrist say?
He said I was living in a dream world.
Mm.
He read letters from the doctors to the insurance company. I mean, I knew that by this time I'm 17 surgeries into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that by then these great surgeons had tried everything they knew to do and nothing worked. So once it didn't work, they said, oh, well, you're never going to get well. But they never really confronted me. But the psychiatrist, a loving, caring man, he read a letter from the head of the Department of General Surgery. Because I hurt my back on the job, so state and industrial insurance was paying for all the bills. And after a couple surgeries, the insurance company started writing letters to the doctor saying, when are you going to fix this guy?
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors wrote letters back. And this letter says, Dear Sirs, as you may not be aware, Mr. McBride's condition is not curable. He'll have chronic osteomyelitis for the balance of his life. And because of the severity of the infection and the invasiveness of the procedures needed to keep the drains open, unless Mr. McBride is extremely fortunate, he will be left with significant permanent disability. Hmm. And the psychiatrist looked up at me and he said, Terry, there's a chance you're going to spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair. And if you come work with me, I can assist you to face that reality, if it happens, with dignity.
Hmm. What'd you say to that?
And I said, I don't want to believe like you. I know what you guys believe, but I don't want to believe like you. And so we argued and we fought. And I cursed. then he read a letter from a general surgeon that talked about the lower end of Mr. McBride's colon has been so involved with the E. coli infection, it probably won't heal. And he looked up and he said, you're probably going to have a colostomy the rest of your life. And if you come work with me, I can assist you to face that reality without your anger. And I said, I don't want to learn how to live with a colostomy without my anger. I'm studying these principles and these books. These books, they say there's a part of me that's not sick. And what these books say is that there's a part of me that's not afraid. And what these books say is that if I can get in touch with that part of me, if I can really own that who I am is that aspect of me that's not sick, that's not afraid, from there, I can create reality. I can learn to create reality rather than face reality. And he smiled and said, son, that's your ego talking. And I told him to go to hell and got up and walked out of his office.
Wow, that was pretty gutsy on your part. I'm fascinated by the divinity within. And when did you start calling it that? Because that's what you were using yesterday when I heard you speak.
Well, I'm not sure in my 20s I called it the divinity within. You know, I've been studying and teaching this stuff now for 45 years. So I may have talked about the power. I didn't say there's a part of me that's divine, and from there I can create. There's a part of me that's not sick. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure what I could call that.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm at Unity, I talk about the divinity within, because that's Unity. That's the language that Unity uses. You know, the Christ within, the divine presence. When I'm at Science of Mind, I use their language. When I speak at a group, I try and use the language that they use to talk about this aspect of self.
And I loved yesterday when you mentioned that it's also big in the ancient Hindu texts, in the Bhagavad Gita and so on.
Well, I think there's this theme that moves through all of the great scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Buddhist philosophy, Buddha said you're a sum total of the thoughts that you allow to dominate your mind. The Hindu teachings teach the mind, when developed enough, can create form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it can create material representations in and of itself without any physical labor. The Magi, the guys who came to visit Jesus at his birth, the ancient mystery school of the Magi in Persia, taught about how to discipline the mind, how to take control of the creative mind, and out of that, as you believe, so shall it be done unto you. You can take charge of your beliefs and thereby take charge of what happens to you.
Which you did.
So that's
you
kept
going.
That's the kind of stuff I played with.
Well, you must have had some really dark nights of the soul as you went through all this, huh?
Oh, boy.
One or two, huh,
yeah.
Huh, Terry?
Yeah, a whole bunch. I mean, it wasn't one happy upward climb after I read. I mean, I'd get on track and be using this stuff. And it wasn't just metaphysics stuff. I was biofeedback. You know, that we can take charge of our mind, we can affect the body. But biofeedback talks about how to lower blood pressure, how to decrease the heart rate. And so, you know, I used some of those techniques when I would have surgery to talk to my body about how it was going to handle the anesthetic, how it was going to handle the pain. And so this idea of moving to the point where I thought, you know, my mind can create reality. I mean, it was, you know, I read books like that in the beginning, but I didn't really understand what do they mean? How does this work? So I just kept applying it and kept applying it and kept applying it. And sometimes I'd throw my hand up and stick it to my forehead, you know, and just go, oh God, ain't it awful? And I'd do that for weeks or months at a time. And then I'd go, well, you want to stay here or you want to get back on track?
So you were at some level, you were very dedicated, because that took years and years, didn't it?
Yes, it did, and I was, but I wasn't always on track.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes people come and say, "Oh boy, you must have been on track all the time. It's like, no, I wasn't. I'd be on track for a while, and then I'd get lost in my drama and the story, and then I'd get back on track, and then I'd get lost in the story and the drama. I'd be doing great for a couple months, and then they'd go in and do a surgery and come in and say, whoops, it's spread again. And, you know, and then I'd spend 2-3 weeks going, ain't it awful?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd go into my victim role.
Did you have peaks? Did you have, like little plateaus where suddenly things were getting better than they expected?
Yeah, well, what it was little gains, like I used to have trouble coming out of the anesthetic, so then I started talking to my body before we'd go into surgery. And it was like if my daughters were, if we were going to take them to the doctor and get a shot, I would talk to them before. This is what's going to happen, and I know it might be scary, but this is what's going to happen. This will be okay. And so what I started doing before I'd go in, when I'd go in the hospital for a surgery, I'd talk to my body the same way. I'd rub my arms and my shoulders and say, look, we're going to have surgery tomorrow, but this is why we're doing this. And body, I want you to be okay. You don't have to get all painful and scream and go, oh, what's happening? Because, you know, this is, and so I'd sort of explain it to my body. And what I found was when I would do that kind of stuff before the surgery, I'd come out of the anesthetic easier. I could have less pain. And I began to heal. There's one point in the surgery where they started mid-back about an inch and a half wide and just took all the tissue out of my back and buttocks.
I can't even imagine thinking about that. Ugh.
And that's, the idea was this infection is so involved in the spine, and the antibiotic, there's not a good blood supply in bone. And so one of the problems is how do we get this antibiotic into that area? And so they came up after, you know, this was about the 12th or 13th surgery. They said, look, we're just going to take all the tissue out so we can see your spine, and then we're going to put the antibiotics right on your spine.
Oh.
And they said, when we do this, we're going to put you in a body cast from your knees to your upper chest, and that we're going to lay you on your back, and it's probably going to take about 6 months for that to heal in. And so you'll be in a body cast for 6 months. Well, by now, I'm using visualization, applied imagination. And so when I was in the body cast, every day I would imagine the tissue granulating in, I would talk to it and all that stuff. Well, I was in the body cast for 2.5 months.
Wow, that's pretty good. Oh, wow.
Yeah, and in the medical, in my medical records, because I have all my medical records, it says, and Mr. McBride healed remarkably well. And so I took that as evidence that what I was doing made a difference. And so as this process evolved, I began to notice that what I did made a difference. Not a huge difference, but a difference. And
that is pretty huge. That's almost as third as that's almost a third the time they thought it was going to take. So that's pretty huge, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what I teach people is to start right where you are. For when I started using affirmations, you know about affirmations.
Oh, you know, sure, yes.
Choosing what we think about. I couldn't lay in bed and go, I, Terry McBride, am now perfectly healthy. I mean, I'd do that, my little voice inside would go, yeah, right, look at yourself, you know. So what I decided was I was going to use these principles just to take the next step. So one of the things, again, I talk about my book, The Hell I Can't.
Mm-hmm.
It says that, so I decided I'm gonna just see if I can start making a difference in my beliefs. Because what, I didn't know that I could change beliefs. I mean, where I came from, my beliefs were true. This is the way the world works. And so for somebody to come in and just say, well, you can change your beliefs, it's like, what do you mean change my beliefs? This is the way the world works. So when I decided, because what I found after about, I don't know, 12 or 15 surgeries that I had bought into, even though I was telling everybody to shove it, I really had bought into this thing that I was never going to get well.
Hmm.
So I wrote an affirmation that said, it might be possible for me to be well someday. And when I and the idea was every day in the morning and in the afternoon and then in the evening, I would just read that and pretend, what if that was true? And when I first started, I would say, it might be possible for me to be well someday. And my little voice inside, the voice inside go, oh, no, and I just say, all I'm saying is it might be possible. I'm not saying I'm going to. I'm just saying it might be possible. And I just stuck with that.
So you got in step and with what you could actually believe at the time.
Exactly. Mm. And so about 3 weeks into that, I was sitting in one day, and I said, it might be possible for me to be well someday. And the answer that came from my mind was, okay, it might be possible.
Wonderful.
And what I got was, oh, my gosh, I changed my mind. By using this thing that they called affirmation and just sticking with it, I changed the response from my mind.
And that little voice inside of you was kind of defending your old beliefs, wasn't it? And it's changing.
I'm not, well, I wouldn't say defending. The little voice inside is my beliefs.
Mm. Sometimes it's really hard for people to realize their belief, to know what we believe. You know, it's really difficult sometimes to find that.
Well, yeah, but at that time I was writing every day.
Yeah.
I learned early on that if one really wants to use these principles, they can't just think about them, they have to apply them.
Right.
So I had a journal, I had read journal books about journaling, I had read books about setting written and specific goals, and so I was writing, and so when I say I would go every day and say it might be possible for me to be well, I had other things, I have a lot of wonderful things that are working in my life, and I'm going to focus on those, my daughters, how healthy they are, how beautiful they are, how magnificent they are, and I'm not just going to focus on the things that isn't working. It's so, I had these rituals, if you will, that I was using. I spent time imagining that my body was healing, like I talked about in the Bodycast. I would, if I was going in for surgery, I would start talking to my body a couple days before and saying, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to handle it, it's going to be okay. And what I found when I did that is that my body wasn't, it wasn't like that. It was sort of like, okay, this is going on, I was told this is going to happen, and this is how I'm going to handle it. And so I started to just take control of the creative process that is my life.
So how long did it take you? I mean, you had surgeries for 11 years, and you were doing these processes all the way through it, right?
In the beginning, the first year and a half, I was waiting for them to fix me. After about a year and a half, when they said, the night of the sixth surgery, they came in and said, we're going to open you from the front, we're going to open you from the back, we're going to open both your buttocks, and then we're going to tip up in and come in between your scrotum and rectum. We have to clean all that out.
Oh, dear.
And like I said on Sunday, they were going to gut me like a dead deer. And then when they said that, and there were these loving, caring doctors. I mean, there were six of them in the room, and some of them had tears in their eyes. They're standing there telling this 24-year-old male with his wife sitting there with a 2-year-old daughter who's just, I mean, she got what was going on as soon as they walked in the room. She could feel their energy. But, what they said was, when we're done with this, we're pretty sure you're going to lose the use of your left leg. You're probably going to lose some of the mobility of your right leg. There's a good chance you're going to lose the control of your bladder. And there's a chance you're going to end up sexually impotent. And after it left, the resident who had been with me for the 2 weeks of tests sat on my bed. And then when I finally calmed down, he said, we don't know what's going to happen. We've never seen anything like this. But what we do know is you cannot expect to come out of this one whole. And that's why the name of my book is The Hell I Can.
Good for you.
And so that was when I decided I need to start doing something. I need to begin to to participate in this rather than wait for somebody else to fix me. And that's when I started reading and studying and applying.
Did you bring in your hypnotherapy friend?
No, he wasn't a hypnotherapist. He was a psychology professor who did his thesis on hypnosis. And so we talked about the mind. But I didn't really understand it. I mean, we just used to, you know, go out and have a beer and talk about that kind of stuff. It was a long process of me discovering who I was and how powerful I was. Like I said, you know, all things are possible if you believe they are, Terry. Hold the faith. Keep the vision. Never give up. But after 9 or 10 or 12 surgeries, all of a sudden, well, perhaps this is some sacred contract you made before you came in, and before your life's purpose can be fulfilled, you have to fulfill the contract. Perhaps there's a lesson in here you're supposed to learn. Perhaps God has a bigger plan for you than you just getting what you want. I mean, in the beginning, God wants you to be well, but you fail enough times, and somebody will say, well, perhaps God has a bigger plan. And these perhaps models, they're not negative. They're meant to give somebody hope. But what I talk about in the book is, in these perhaps models, there was the real probability that I would not get well.
Well, they're a shift in perception, aren't they? It's like perceive success as being different than what you think right now. What do you think about soul journey? Do you think you had a soul journey that really... do you think we do have a soul journey, or do you think that can be redescribed by changing our beliefs over and over?
Oh, I think that I think that there is a journey. I think that life is more than just the human existence. I think the soul continues. I'm sort of goosey about too much talking about soul journey, because then my experience has been that the soul journey is determined before you come in. You know, like a sacred contract. You make a contract before you come in.
Right.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised whether I came in with an agenda. What I have trouble with is that I don't get to change that agenda now.
Now that's a really good point. I've been reading lots about that lately. You can change your path by choice is what I've been reading.
Yeah,
about.
That's what I think. Mm-hmm. You know, but I may have come in with an agenda. I may have had an agenda when I was young.
But there may be the learning that you get to teach other people to empower themselves in such a way. I mean, there may be that in your agenda.
Well, where I come from is I get to make it up, period.
Great. That's wonderful.
You know, when I've told somebody, well, I'm going to change that, they say, no, this contract you came in is sacred. We're talking about a sacred contract. What I tell them is, I'm sacred, therefore I get to make a new contract.
I love that. That's great.
And so one of the challenges with the soul journey and me studying that kind of stuff is too many authors talked about that the soul's journey is all cast in stone and you don't get to change it. Mm-hmm. And what I come from is, no, I'm still that holy individual. I can change this journey if I choose to. Of course, if you say that, people go, who do you think you are?
Well, what's the answer to that, Terry? You got a good answer for that.
I think I'm a unique incarnation of the divine spirit.
Right on. I
that's
love that.
Thing. And from that, mm-hmm. if I own that, mm-hmm. then I have absolute authority over this physical plane. Mm-hmm. All things are possible if only I believe they are. Mm-hmm. Of course, you say that, and I go again, who do you think you are? That's what, when I told the psychiatrist, I'm not going to believe like you. He said, when I said these books and stuff, he said, Terry, who do you think you are? And he didn't say, what books are you reading? He didn't say, what authors are you reading? He didn't say, what experts are you referring to? When I disagreed with him and his scientific approach based on my medical records, he said, who do you think you are? Essentially, what he was saying is, who do you think you are to disagree with these facts that I've presented? Well, I certainly wasn't going to tell the psychiatrist that I thought I was a unique incarnation of the divine spirit. I mean, mean, you say that I was already in the psych department, you know, the psych ward in my hospital pajamas and hospital robe. You say stuff like that, and they give you a coat that ties in the back.
I know.
And it wasn't that this psychiatrist was negative. He studied disease.
Disease, yeah.
And how to deal with it. I was studying wellness and how to create it. And they're not the same things. Learning how to deal with disease is not the same as learning how to create wellness.
Well, that's true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just studying different things. When I got back and told that one of the nurses, you know, well, she read the report. And she came in later and said, you know, he's the most loving doctor in the hospital. I've known him for 15 years. So it wasn't that he was a negative man. He just studied disease. Mm-hmm. And when he finally came, look, you're going to have this disease forever. This is the reality of it. You come work with me, I can assist you to face that reality. And what I said was, I don't want to believe like you guys. Mm-hmm. I study in this other discipline that says I can change it. And that's when he said, who do you think you are? But he never asked me what books I was reading. He never said what teachers. One of the challenges I think that's out there is when we disagree with people, they shut us off. Oh, that's your ego talking. Mm-hmm. Well, what can you say to that? And what I noticed early on was it was always my ego talking. It was mm-hmm. never their ego talking.
Well, you know, when I heard you say that on Sunday, I thought I've been doing a lot of reading about the ego because I'm always exploring as well. And the ego, it is fine if it's your ego talking because it's a really valid part of us. It's what we do with it that gets to be the problem, right?
Well, I think when one brings up the ego in a room full of people, nobody's talking the same things.
Exactly.
So as you say, that's your ego. Everybody in the room's got a different opinion.
Right.
From what I studied is Freud was the one who brought in the idea of the ego as part of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Ego means one in, I think, in Latin or Greek or whatever.
I mean, he just said it's a viable part of the mind? Is that what he said?
And what he brought in, he says the ego is the part of the mind that gathers information from the senses, compares it to stored data, and then the ego, based on the stored data, says this is what's happening and this is what you ought to do. So when there's an error in the information, if you will, or the error in what I ought to do, it's not the ego's problem. It's the stored data's problem. The ego is what drives the car. Mm-hmm. We drive down the road, and the ego is gathering information from the senses, sight, sound, and making decisions based on stored data about how to steer your car, whether to get in this lane, whether to look over your shoulder. And nobody ever makes the ego wrong for how it drives the car. But there's a, you know, I.
But if the ego chooses.
Talk about,
sorry.
What happens is when the stored data is wrong, then this part of the mind that gathers information compares it to stored data. It can give you a choice of action that may not be appropriate. If somebody grows up in an environment where they're told you're worthless, you're no good, you're never going to amount to anything, they'll be out into their world. They gather information through the senses. The ego goes in and compares it to stored data, which says you're never going to amount to anything, you're worthless, and comes up with a conclusion that says you're worthless.
Hmm.
It's not the ego's problem, it's the stored data's problem.
That's right.
Or at least that's how I hold it. Because when I told the psychiatrist, I'm going to get well, he said, that's your ego talking.
Well, I sort of laughed because you were talking about driving the car, the ego. You know, we use our ego for that. And I go, I guess if you only drive a Ferrari and think you're more important, that's taking the ego a little farther, isn't it?
No, so you still got ego as something negative.
No, I was just thinking that we frame it according to what we've decided. What I mean is a person might boast of their ego or feel that they're more important by what they drive rather than just driving.
But that's based on the stored data.
I know, yeah. I was just playing with the idea.
Anyway, so I never like, you know, I don't like the books that the authors that want to go make the ego wrong.
Mm-hmm. No, we need it.
You know,
it's important.
It may have some may make some erroneous decisions based on stored data. You know, sometimes something happens and it goes inside, and the natural reaction is punch them in the nose. Well, that's just stored data. That's from the old, you know, I'm tougher and bigger than anybody out there. You know, that kind of stuff. And so what I want to do is retrain the stored data, so when the same information comes in, that instead of wanting to punch them in the nose, said maybe they need a little more love. Maybe they need, you know, a little more understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what I did was just try not to make anything in this marvelous mind and body inherently bad.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe I have a saboteur within.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. A lot of people really believe that, don't they?
Well, that's because somebody wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people, there's an archetypal model. Carl Jung was a psychiatrist, and he said there are these archetypes, models, that people believe in. One of them is that there's something evil within the human condition. We used to call it Satan. Now we don't call it Satan. Many people won't allow somebody to come and say, Satan lives within you, and it's always trying to separate you from your dreams. We won't allow that. We say, no, I don't believe that. But if somebody comes up and says, you have a saboteur within you that's always trying to separate you from your dreams, we go, oh, really? We have a small self that's always trying to substitute the word Satan. You got the same idea. It's been around a long time.
But don't you ever have a voice that questions you?
Oh yeah, I have limiting beliefs.
Okay.
I have limiting habit patterns, limiting strategies, but I know how to change limiting beliefs. I don't know anybody that's ever gotten rid of their ego. It's like I said last night in my workshop. How many of you in here have ever heard that before you can have the healing you desire, you need to forgive everybody you've ever held anything against? About half the people raised their hand. And I said, good. Does anybody in here know anybody that's ever forgiven everybody they've ever held anything against? Nobody raised their hand. How many of you have ever heard that before you can really be happy, you need to get rid of your ego? Most of the people raised their hand. And then I said, good. How many of you know somebody who's ever gotten rid of their ego? Nobody raised their hand. I said, if you just believe those two things, if just those two, you don't get to have the healing you want because you haven't forgiven everybody, and you don't get to be happy because you got an ego. I just think it's a silly way to make up life.
Well, it certainly gives us a lot of rules that keep us back, right?
Yeah, and you know, so as I was, you know, studying and reading, what I began to find was I'm not going to read anything that makes part of me sick. I don't read books. I don't appreciate it when authors say I have a monkey mind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind where the Hindu writings say an undisciplined mind can seem like a maddened monkey. Because there are times when my mind is going, you know, crazy. But that's only because it's not disciplined. It's not because my mind is a monkey mind. Mm-hmm. You see the difference?
I sure do. Mm-hmm.
And so there are some people and some teachers who I don't think hold the human condition, the human mind, and the human body in the same reverence that I hold it. And so what happens is you have a saboteur within, a small self that will always separate you from your good, your ego that will always try and separate you from God. I mean, how, you know, I used to wonder what kind of self-image must these people have that the thing they fear most lives right within them.
Well, you're deepening people's choice, aren't you? You're saying deepen into and make your choices at a deeper and deeper level so that you can believe more expandedly, right?
Well, it's like that. It's like that. I just found it didn't support me in trying to get well after 15 or 16 or 18 surgeries to begin to believe that there was something within me that wanted to keep me sick.
Mm-hmm.
There are wonderful authors out there that say, you know, in the Old Testament it says we're the crowning achievement of the living God. And the scholars that talk about that say they're not talking about your spiritual nature. That, you know, great prophet who was writing about that was talking about your human nature, your human mind, and your human body is the crowning achievement of the living God. Well, if I believe that, why would I then go, oh, and in this crowning achievement in my mind, I got a saboteur, I got a, you know, and it goes on and on. So what I decided was, why did, when, in these areas of my mind that don't support me or that I want to change, why don't I just call them limiting beliefs? Mm-hmm. Why don't I just call them limiting habit patterns? Because I know how to change limiting beliefs and how to change limiting habit patterns. So I just began to language it in such a way, so I know this sounds terrible, but so I had control over my mind, rather than my mind having control over me.
Yeah, I don't think that sounds terrible. It sounds like it was a real art for you, a really incredible technology.
Yeah, and I think that's what metaphysics is about. Mm-hmm. I think that's what, you know, the great teacher Jesus was talking about when he said all things are possible if you believe they are.
I always say he said, anything I can do, you can do better.
Exactly. Yeah, because he did.
Yes.
You know.
Well, so how long, I mean, so you took surgeries for like 11 years. Were you starting to separate from being a sick guy quite well before that 11 years? Or what was the timeline like for you?
Oh, I was, before that I got, I mean, I'd never broken a bone. I was always healthy. Hmm. And so it really, you know, I ruptured a disc working construction and did chiropractic and osteopathic and physical therapy, and the pain just got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And finally, you know, I went and had an MRI, and the guy said, look, you got a ruptured disc and it's really protruding out on both sides. A ruptured disc is like an inner tube with a big bulge in it, and these bulges are hitting the nerves going down your legs, and the best way to clean that up. I mean, you've done a whole year of exercises. You've been on track. You're in better shape now than probably you'll ever be. I was like 22, 23. And he said, and it hasn't got better in a year, so I suggest we do a fusion. The fusion stopped the pain. It mm-hmm. healed the bad back. The problem was the spine got infected, and mm-hmm. then all the rest of the surgeries were out of the infection. Mm. Well, and even after I had the last surgery, it was about 7 years before I really believed it was over.
Wow.
So that and was... even then, and I had lots of pain, even after the surgeries were gone. And then I decided, well, if I could use those tools to get rid of the infection, maybe I can use these tools to get rid of the pain. And then so I started using the tools to talk to my body to get rid of the pain. And I had a good friend of mine, Bill Luria, is a great plastic surgeon. I talked Sunday about his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Isaac Luria, who's one of the three most influential teachers in the history of the Kabbalah, mm-hmm. the mystical side of Judaism. Anyway, Bill and I are good friends, and he's a plastic surgeon in Tampa. And so I was having dinner with him one night. I was rubbing my abdomen. He says, what's going on? I said, I don't know. I just got this pain down here. So he said, come on in tomorrow. So I came in. He did an exam. And he says, you've got all these scar tissue down here, and you've got all these adhesions because your scars aren't flexible, and the muscle, the tissue that's next to it is stretching. And so he said, let's go in and clean up all those scars on your tummy, and we'll move your belly button over in the middle where it's supposed to be. So he did this big surgery. Afterwards, he said, look, you're probably going to have ongoing surgeries like this to relieve the tension on these adhesions because you have so much scar tissue inside. So I went home, got out my piece of paper, and sat down and said, all right, I don't want to have any more surgeries, so what do I need to do here? And every day for 5 minutes, I'd just write on it. Just write on it. What might you do? What might you do? And after several days, what I got is you have two choices. You can either disappear your scars, or you can make your scars flexible.
Oh, that's good.
So I went, so I just took, all right, so how hard do I think it's going to be to disappear my scars? And so I wrote every day for 3 or 4 minutes. I'd sit down and write about it. And sometimes I write a lot. Sometimes I wouldn't write much. After a couple days, what I found was, I think that's going to be really difficult. So then I went over to the other one. Well, what about, how difficult do you think it's going to be to make your scars flexible? And what I found was I did not have a belief about that. I mean, I'd heard the scars aren't flexible, but I'd never bought into it. So what I decided was, okay, why don't I just make my scars flexible? So then I went to use these principles that I talk about in my workshop and in the Everybody Wins program and in the book. You know, if they go to my website, there's videos that I talk about these ideas. And what I did was spend about, oh, I'll bet it was only 10 days or 2 weeks, every day talking to my body about my scars are flexible, my scars are flexible. Well, I haven't had any problems with adhesions now since I did that.
So what? Somebody said, all you do is write and talk? That's all you've done for that?
Oh, I mean, I write out, what am I going to do? Because what I find, if I don't write my ideas down, if I just think about it, and then, well, I'll go back to this tomorrow. When I go back tomorrow, I think about the same things.
Mm-hmm.
So if I write out my ideas, the next time I go back to it, my mind goes, well, we already thought about this. What else might be? And you get underneath your own mm-hmm. thinking. And I didn't just write out, oh, my scars are flexible. Mm-hmm. I've been using this stuff for, you know, that was probably 8 or 10 years ago. I've been using and teaching this stuff for 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
So when I decide I'm going to go do this, I've got tools and techniques that I've perfected my way over years of applying these principles.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, what I found was after about 2 weeks, when I would go to do my work, I just knew my scars were flexible and they weren't going to cause me any more problems.
Hmm.
Of course, if you go tell that to some scientists, if they said, why don't you have any problems with adhesions? If I told them, well, I've made my scars flexible, they just look at you and say, who do you think you are?
So tell me, when did you get your colostomy reversed? Was that 11 years after or...
Oh, no, I got the colostomy. That was when I decided. So I'm studying all these principles. I'm handling the surgeries better. I'm recovering faster. I'm doing all this stuff. But I had found out that I had bought into, I'm going to have this infection the rest of my life. So I really think these principles, this idea of taking charge of my creative mind, I really think that can work. But where do I start? Because I don't believe I'm ever going to be well. So again, most every day I go, well, where can I start using this stuff? If I was going to start using this and really applying it on a consistent basis, where do I start? And what I just, after writing, I got, well, what about the colostomy? And so I went in every day, I would write, what do I think about my colostomy? What do I believe about my colostomy? What do I believe about healing? You know, all that stuff. And what I found was I didn't believe I could heal it. But I didn't think I would have the colostomy forever. That was as good as it got.
Hmm.
So these books that say, when you start a project, you have to believe 100% that you can finish it and it will succeed. Oh, bull. I don't know anybody that ever believed 100%. Those are people writing from the top of the ladder looking down. They've never been down at the bottom trying to dig their way out. And so they give you these, you got to believe 100%, you got to do this. And it's just, you know, what I talk about in my stuff is start with a believable hope. And so I decided, well, why don't I start using these principles to see if I can heal my colon and get the colostomy reversed? And so I set out on a plan. What has to happen? And then, you know, it was finally I sat down with a doctor and said, what has to happen in my body before you're willing to solve the colostomy? And he gave me a list.
Hmm.
He said, well, you know, the lower end of the colon has to heal, so there's the holes heal up. Number two, I'm not going to do an elective surgery on you while your white blood cell count has skyrocketed. You're a very sick boy. Number three, I'm not going to do an elective surgery and open up your abdomen to fix this colon while you have a draining sinus from this infection in your spine, because we'll cross-infect into your belly again if you've got this, you know, pus coming out from these holes, and we're not going to do that. So I won't do this surgery on you if you have a draining sinus. And he said, and there was another one. But anyway, so I decided, okay, one at a time, what do I need to do to heal the colon? Number two, what do I need to do so that my white blood cell, white blood count isn't skyrocketed? Because what the, you know, the white blood cells would go, oh my God, there's an infection. And they'd create all these other white blood cells to deal with the infection. So how do I get the body to not get so, and so anyway, it just systematically, it took a year.
It took a
but
year.
Every day I would work, every day I would work on it. Every day I would imagine, you know, the colon healing. I would imagine, you know, my body beginning to, I built this whole pretend game that my immune system would go and go, oh, there's an E. coli infection. And then I would talk to my immune system and tell it, you don't have to be excited about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had this infection forever. You don't have to be excited. Just take it easy. You don't need to send out red flags. You know, I built this whole pretend game. And then, you know, 6-8 months later when I had, you know, it walks it through the book, how I did this.
Stuff. I loved it. Well, we're going to have to end this because we're out of time. We're not out of interest, but we're out of time. So if people want to read the book, how do they find the book?
So they can go to terrymcbride.net. That's my website. It's got you can order the book. You can order it on Kindle or any of the other e-books. There's also, from my website, you can go to my YouTube account, which has videos. There's about 6 videos up there talking about these various principles. And we're just going to do the rollout of that in about a week or 10 days. And then I'm just going to keep doing short videos, you know, so ultimately there'll be a whole bunch. But right now there are 6. So it's terrymcbride.net.
Wow. And you also have a program that takes people through taking charge of their own reality. What's that program called again, Terry?
It's called Everybody Wins. It's a 9-week, I started teaching and people would go, you know, I'd come back and they weren't using it. So I took a year off and wrote the Everybody Wins program, which is a step-by-step program that only takes about 10 minutes a day. And over the 9 weeks, people go, oh, this is how it works.
It's on CDs, right?
Yeah, it's on CDs, there's a workbook, there's a printed text, and on my website it talks about that, about how it works and how to get one, and it's brilliant.
And so we're going to check terrymcbride.net, but also, do you think it's going to work on the government?
I don't know what you mean by that.
Politics, can we affect politics this way?
All things are possible if we believe they are.
Yay. So this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much, Terry McBride. You've really lifted us and reminded us of amazing possibilities. We're amazing critters, aren't we?
Thanks, Veronica. I appreciate the work you're doing and your show and the difference you make in the world.
Thanks.
Way to
for
go,
that.
Girl.
Thanks for helping us with that. So good night, Terry.
Good night, Veronica. Thank you so much.
Thank you again. And safe travels as you hit the road.
Thanks.
This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening to Paradigm Shifters. That was Terry McBride. Check out his website, terrymcbride.net. And also, if you'd like a session with me or even with Terry, email me, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com. And also, if you have suggestions for other guests or feedback on Terry's discussion with us tonight, veronica@veronicaentwistle.com, no H in Entwistle. Take a deep breath, everybody, and breathe blessings out to everyone in our Paradigm Shifters community. Good night. Thank you. Thank you.